This is The Political Animals, conversations at the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole, and in this episode, I'm interviewed by Josh Lewis of the Saving Elephants podcast on the topic of political theology. G'day everyone. Something a little different in this episode. I had the privilege of making my second and third appearances on the Saving Elephants podcast, hosted by Josh Lewis over in the great United States of America, and we had a discussion about political theology. Josh was a guest on The Political Animals about a year or two ago. We discussed the issue of right-wing populism, and Josh republished that episode on his show, and he was kind enough to let me republish this part one of political theology, and also in the coming weeks, part two of our conversation on political theology. And the reason I wanted to do that is my show ostensibly, as the intro says, is about conversations at the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. As some of you know, I'm actually a full-time academic, and my area of scholarship is political theology. Yet, somewhat surprisingly, when I look back over the corpus thus far, well over 100 episodes, I think I've only actually done one on the topic of political theology, and that was with John Milbank earlier this year, a very popular episode that you should check out if you haven't already. So I thought, well, given I've done these two substantial conversations with Josh on the topic of political theology, why not bring it to my show? Because I could do with a bit more political theology as it happens. So be sure to check out Josh's podcast, Saving Elephants, which I'll link in the show notes. While I have your attention, and just before I roll tape and we dive into Josh's show, perhaps you could take a moment to give the show a 5-star rating on Apple and or Spotify if you haven't already. And of course, if you like the show and enjoy it and want to support it, whether you do or you don't, whether you have or you haven't, as always, thanks for listening. And I hope you enjoy this part one of my conversation with Josh on political theology.
You're listening to the Saving Elephants show.
Jonathan, it's good to have you back. I recall the last time I had you on the podcast, I opened with an entirely unfair and dreadful question asking you to define right out the gate, what is conservatism? And so I thought, in keeping with that spirit, because I had read something you've written here, that you note that most doctrinal students dread that question, what is your PhD about? But you say you actually dread another question, asking someone asking you to define what is political theology. So in keeping with that same spirit, what is political theology?
Josh, it's great to be with you again, and good to see you're staying on the theme of asking me extremely difficult questions to begin with. And I'm not sure which is a less desirable question, what is conservatism or what is political theology? But since you've asked, it's a very simple and obvious question. I get asked it all the time, not just by non-Christians or non-religious people, but also by Christians. And there is no simple answer. And the reason for that is that political theology, if we want to get technical, describes two quite distinct academic discourses which have their own histories and don't actually intersect very much. And the first one actually originates in a book written by the German legal theorist and Nazi ideologue, incidentally, Carl Schmitt, in 1922, I think it was, called Political Theology. And that book had a famous thesis, which was that most political concepts, or many political concepts, are secularized theological concepts. And Schmitt was really mounting a historical argument that there had been this great transition from a period throughout much of European history where theology was really central to political concepts, political understanding, and that there'd been the shift towards a secularization of political concepts. And in order to understand our contemporary political concepts, we had to go back to their theological roots. And Carl Schmitt was unknown in English for much of the 20th century, but he was introduced to English-speaking scholars, interestingly, by a German Jewish American or America-based scholar by the name of George Schwab, who started translating Schmitt's works. And actually, that book, Political Theology, wasn't translated until 1985 in English. That's quite a gap from 1922. And to cut that long story short, there's enormous interest in Carl Schmitt. He's now a celebrated thinker, regarded as this really key figure of the 20th century. And there are many, many scholars doing work on him. And that literature, and it's all described as political theology, the term occurs frequently in all the works and the titles, is really about contemporary liberalism and sovereignty. And for someone trained in theology such as myself, there's not actually a lot of theology, and it's a bit of a perplexing use of the term. But in any event, I don't want to dwell on that. That's one literature or discourse, which is now just over 100 years old, and that's very hot at the moment in Europe and North America. Then interestingly, in the late 60s and early 70s, entirely separately, we get a couple of theologians, also German, interestingly, the Catholic theologian Johann B. Metz, and then the Reformed German theologian Jürgen Moltmann. These will be familiar names to anyone that's au fait with theology. They write a couple of essays. I think Metz goes first in about 1968, then Moltmann follows up in 1971. And they start writing about this thing called political theology, but with a very different meaning from Schmitt. And what they're concerned about is the depoliticization, as they see it, of Christianity. And they're really calling for a repoliticization. What are they talking about? You've got to remember the period here, late 60s, early 70s. They think Christianity has become a socially irrelevant, hollowed out, internal, spiritual religion that has no social impact. It's all about the individual's salvation and the individual's relationship with God. And so when they call for a repoliticization of theology, and in particular the gospel, they say the whole Christ event was about social transformation. It has political ramifications and implications. And the church and Christians need to rediscover this transformative political function, because that is ultimately the essence of the gospel. And the biggest impact this kind of thought has, particularly through Metz, is in liberation theology. And if you know anything about liberation theology, that is really that early, late 60s, early 70s form of political theology in action, with the concern for poverty and the poor and the like. To cut that long story forward today, that's really where the term political theology enters into what I would call traditional Christian theological discourse in English. And I stress in English because obviously it's got a longer history in German and I think in some other European languages. It then diversifies, and so this is where it gets even more complex, and I won't actually try to tease that all out. I'll end this, my own little discourse here, and hand over to you. But it's suffice to say, it's now been about 50 years. It's also very sexy, political theology. And I make a distinction between the Schmittian literature I characterize as secular political theology, because it doesn't really presume any belief in a Christian God or otherwise. And then this other discourse that begins in Metz and Moltmann I characterize as confessional political theology. It's actually confessing Christians doing this particular political theology, who are taking seriously the claims of the Bible and assume that the church is this important vehicle for salvation or whatever. But it's very eclectic now. So it's actually moved on from that first concern of repoliticizing Christianity. Metz and Moltmann, of course, were unaware, for example, just to take an example, of the evangelical support of Donald Trump, which is a kind of Christian political theology in action, but it's clearly not what they were thinking about. So a lot has happened historically across the world. Russia is another example where you get a political theology where the church is basically backing a war of conquest in Ukraine. And so you've got conservative, progressive, liberal, Marxist, anarchist political theology. And I suppose I'm probably just overselling the point now that it's diverse and eclectic and contested. And so for those three reasons, or two reasons really, the fact that there are two distinct discourses and the fact that the confessional political theology, which is what I work in mostly, is so diverse that it's hard to even give a simple, succinct, pristine definition because it really depends which political theologian you're talking about.
So if I compress the history of what you've been talking about and Americanize it, which is something any red-blooded American wants to do. When you're describing this, the 1960s, 70s, say, variant of this, where it sounds really similar or reminiscent to the social gospel movement of the early progressive era, or maybe we could say the populist era of, say, the 1880s through up through the progressive era, in that it weds Christian doctrine or faith with sort of a more than just the individual, but also some sort of a social directive, usually aimed at the poor or some sort of perceived injustice that needs to be addressed. And so maybe this is a two-part question, because as I say, I'm trying to compress the history. I'm trying to Americanize this. If I think of that era up through, say, the 60s and 70s, where the term political theology is used for that purpose, and then I think of up on through today, you yourself are both a scholar of political theology, but also a self-professed conservative. I'm wondering, help me understand that. Is that just some more of the mess? Like, how does someone such as yourself with your conservative beliefs, which we talked about at great length in the previous episode you were on, is political theology a chiefly social justice movement, or is it broader than that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And let me try and address all of its permutations. Probably just put dread in the listener that I'm going to address every permutation. But just briefly, as a quick clarification, there's really no need to Americanize confessional political theology, because I probably neglected to mention, because I just assume prior knowledge, that Metz and Moltmann, although German, they published those first two key essays in English in American journals. And really, that discourse takes off in America. That's where it originates in the late 60s and 70s. One other useful clarification, I think, is that you're right, that I'm really talking about political theology in the sense of when the concept explicitly enters into theological literature. And like I say, there's a very particular point in time when that happens, namely 1968. But of course, you can look back anachronistically, and thinking anachronistically is not a bad word in my mind. It's just to acknowledge that you can see the existence of concepts and ideas, but they're named differently. And the social gospel, social ethics, these kind of terms can be seen, particularly in America, going all the way back to Niebuhr. I mean, you could regard Reinhold Niebuhr, for example, as one of the most significant political theologians of the 20th century, but that probably would have been news to him. But of course, he thought and wrote at the intersection of faith and politics. And you could also think of someone like John Howard Yoder, who in 73, I think it is, or 72, writes The Politics of Jesus. The term political theology appears nowhere in there, yet I would regard it as one of the most significant works in political theology of that era. And, you know, what was the first work of political theology? Well, it was probably Augustine's City of God, although he was unfamiliar with the term. So I don't want to suggest that political theology, you know, Christians suddenly wake up in 1968 after almost 2,000 years of reflection and basically running entire empires and states for a lot of that period to discover this thing called political theology. It has a long prehistory. It's always there. I think the reason it's not named until 1968 actually is that it was just taken for granted that God was involved in politics and that Christians were involved in politics, and the only way to conceive and understand politics in Christian civilizations were at least in part through theological categories. So to the actual point, that there are enough permutations to explore. The political theology, how do I reconcile or integrate my academic work in political theology with my own personal, what I would regard as philosophical conservatism? Very easily and happily is the answer. And that's because the kind of political theology I do is not actually so much normative, which is what a lot of the field is. I'm really, if we want to get very technical, a scholar of political theology. I would not actually describe myself as a political theologian. So I'm actually interested in the discourse itself. And so I look at more liberal, more progressive types of political theology and more conservative types of political theology. My own particular approach to politics stands in a tradition that goes back to Burke and comes through Russell Kirk, and that's a very intellectual conservative tradition, which is not particularly popular these days, I would say, or is definitely on the outer, as you could expect in an age of populism, which is generally anti-elite and anti-intellectual. So, of course, someone that looks at my own analysis of the discourse of political theology and my interaction with different political theologians. So I've written a book on Oliver O'Donovan, for example. I've written on John Howard Yoder and Jacques Ellul's sort of anarchist political theology, and a whole range of other people have done a lot of work on in Christos Yannaras, who's a Greek Orthodox political thinker. I'm sure someone reading my work might detect the influence, or if they were doing an intellectual history on me, should I ever be regarded as interesting enough to do something? I'm sure they would see an influence of my fundamentally conservative philosophical presuppositions, but that is just to uncover what you'll find in any scholar.
Well, it's so well said, and for the listener who has dared to hang with us for 15 minutes and is still scratching her head saying, I don't understand what political theology is, I still don't get it, I'm going to try to simplify this a little bit and tell me if this works as an elevator pitch maybe for what is political theology. If I'm understanding you correctly, and I borrow some of this from things you've written, it sounds like I could summarize political theology somewhat as answers to theological questions as they relate to governance. And I think you prefer the term governance over politics or the state or statescraft. And again, that's probably super simplifying it more so than we need to, but that I'm wondering, is that a definition that may work for our purposes of our conversation, but might also be one that you could have an Islamic or a Catholic or a Protestant or even an agnostic political theologian in the room and could all agree, yeah, we agree that is essentially what this broader thing we call political theology is the answering of theological questions in their relationship with governance.
Yeah, look, you've very graciously and gently pointed out that despite my soaring tour of the complexities and intricacies of political theology, I never actually offered anything approximating an intelligible
definition. Well, I think it was in there. It was in there. Just it you had to derive it from it, I think.
I'm sure if the listener goes back 10 times and listens over it, they'll get it. But the thing, just as a preface, the thing to remember is that the constituent terms of political theology are both contestable, variable, and unstable. So politics, if we just forget about theology and look at political science, political philosophers, or even just the common man and woman on the street, its semantic boundaries are where basically you want to put it. Some people have a really broad definition of politics or power relationships, which could include the family or just all structures, systems, distribution of resources, or you could narrow it down to things done by a government. So that's diverse. And of course, theology is also diverse because there's Catholic, Pentecostal, Evangelical, Anglican, Orthodox, and then the Serbian Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox are going to be different. And then within the Serbian Orthodox, you might have three different schools. And so not everyone works with the same definition of theology. So if I could think of a definition that encapsulates the breadth of confessional political theology without just noting that it's going to vary because of the variability of those two constituent concepts, I would say that it's thinking through the political implications of the core resources of Christianity. So the doctrines of Christianity, So here's a common example, and I've written on this, the Trinity. Okay. Does the Trinity say anything about politics, the way we should govern, the nature of power and relationship? Well, there's a literature on that. Some say yes, some say no, but that's just an example. Then you can throw in eschatology, Christology. What does it mean that Christ rose from the dead and reigns at the right hand of the Father? That would seem to have some kind of political implications. Creation, it's one of the famous old debates of political theology. Is politics a consequence of and response to sin, which is to say a way of dealing with sin? That's the kind of Augustinian thread through Christian theology. And then there's a Thomist one going back, you know, Aquinas, which is no, politics is part of the created order and it's just been corrupted like everything else in the created order because of the fall. So that's so it's thinking through the political implications of the great doctrines of Christianity. The second part is thinking through the implications of Scripture, the great foundational text of Christianity. So, you know, there's this thing called a covenant with Israel. Israel goes into the promised land. They ask for a king. There's an exile. They rebuild the temple. Goes on and on and on. Seems to have obvious political implications. How are we supposed to understand what that does or doesn't mean for our politics? And then, of course, there's famous explicit teaching like Paul in Romans 13:1, let every person be subject to the authorities. We can read it as political authorities because they are instituted by God, and there are ample passages like that all the way through to the promised New Jerusalem, which some people read as having political implications. And then the third strand of that is the church. So there's this thing called the church that exists that has a history of being wrapped up with political authority. Sometimes the line has been pretty blurry. But even in the context of a liberal democracy, what is the place of the church? Should it have some political role? Should it speak into politics? Should it stay out of politics? How should it relate to the state? Because it has to relate to the state, even in those mundane matters of dealing with the regulations. We're all drowning in regulations now of building a new church and, you know, tax exemption status and, you know, the various approvals you need these days to run any kind of organization. So political theology, ultimately, when you get through all the rhetoric and the diversity, I think it's trying to grapple, and this is the kind of way I think about it, actually, which I could have just started with this without the whole historical tour, thinking through really the political implications of theological doctrine, Scripture, and the existence of the church. And as I've contended in one of my books, I think that's unavoidable. I think all Christians live in some kind of political context and society, and I think it would take an enormous amount of work to avoid ever having to reflect on those questions.
So, first of all, I like that we've narrowed it down to Christianity, because I think while it is an entirely fair and interesting conversation to talk about other religious traditions and its imprint, say, on political theology, it is undeniable that Christianity is the dominant historical form within Australia and the United States, our respective countries. And so you can't have a robust conversation about this topic for very long without focusing on Christian doctrine, Christian theological teachings. I say that, though, however, with a backdrop of a lot of Christians I know take the view that this whole notion of putting too much theology into our politics is dangerous or icky or something I don't want anything to do with, or maybe from a historical perspective, we could even say this to the Europeans, like, well, that's what we fought all those religious wars for, and thank God we have liberal democracies now where I can worship God as I want to worship God, and I'm free to do so, and nobody's trying to kill me for doing that, nor am I trying to impose my theological values, say, on anyone else. I know this is a big issue, but I guess I want to boil it down to the kind of that beginning part, because my impression is that there's an awful lot of Christians who they themselves would see their Christianity as something Christ is someone they serve very, if you'll pardon the pun, religiously. To put that another way, I'm not talking about nominal Christianity who have Christianity as an identifying marker. I'm talking about those who are see their faith as something they take very serious, but also see their faith as something that they deliberately want to keep out of their politics. How do we stay between the... I don't think what you're advocating is let's just return to the old days of European monarchs where the church was so intertwined with politics that, you know, it's hard to tell where one ends and the other begins, versus we're not arguing for religion has nothing to say in the public square. How do we come to that sort of healthier middle where we recognize our religion has to have an imprint on our politics without politics being overwhelmed by our religion?
Yeah, look, the way I would approach that whole problem, challenge, is to actually first say, because it comes down to where you start. I start with the fact that we're all impacted by politics. And it doesn't matter, your religion's irrelevant there. So whether you're an atheist, an agnostic, Muslim, Jew, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, there's virtually no place on earth that is outside of politics. And in fact, we're all born into some kind of political society, polity, and we're all inculcated in that. And it presents for all human beings, although it differs according to context, obligations, rights, and problems and challenges. And if you just look at our political discourse, it's not like it's only Christians that find politics difficult and or who are unhappy with it, or you name it. So I guess that's really to say, my starting assumption is we're all political animals in some sense. The reason that's a useful starting point, I think, is that then brings into focus that the real question for the Christian is, okay, it's given that I have to interact with the political authorities. There are laws I have to obey or choose whether I obey them. I've got to pay a certain amount of taxes, and I'm going to be exposed to political ideas and debates and rhetoric. And if I'm in a democracy, and may as well speak to our context, I'm going to, well, in my country, you have to vote. In your country, you can choose to vote. But I guess that's still a conscious decision you have to make at some point. So then the question is, how much do I bring in my theology into my politics? So that's why I say I think it's useful to think of us as being political really from the moment we're born. The choice, in a sense, is how theological we want our politics to be, and that's where Christians differ. And my general response to that, which I suppose just betrays my Aristotelianism, and I think I'm Aristotelian by temperament, in that I just have a tendency to always find virtue in the mean between two extremes. It's just not even a choice. It just seems to be the way I'm wired, and I'm just conscious I'm about to do that again. But I think you don't want to completely overwhelm your political activities, interactions, and thought with theology, but nor do you want to completely have a hard wall where you push all of your theology, which is really to say your faith, out of politics. And that is actually a challenge. I think what we see a lot today are one of those two tendencies. So we have people who perhaps even unwittingly and unconsciously seem to sacralize the political order or a particular conception of the political order, which then of course makes them very anxious, because if there's some kind of sacred political order that should be in place and it's not in place, then that gives you a real problem. And similarly, there are Christians who profess to be followers of Jesus who somehow are able to say, my faith has nothing to do with politics, or, and this is where I am with Metz and Maltman, although I don't like their general approach to political theology, but I think they're right to pose that question. How can it be possible for a Christian to be a follower of the risen Lord and say what happens in the political realm and the social realm is irrelevant to me and of no interest? I mean, we are called to love our neighbors ourselves, mm-hmm. after all. I don't think it's possible to say this is exactly the way you integrate theology with politics, because we have to allow for the fact that the answer is going to be a little different for a Catholic from an evangelical, and the evangelical might be a bit different from a sort of Anglo-Catholic or Pentecostal or what have you. And of course, the political context is going to be a bit different. So what it means to have a theologically informed approach to politics is really a whole different equation for a Chinese question, Christian, or an Iranian Christian, or indeed a Russian Christian right now. I mean, just think about Romans 13:1 in the context of being a Russian Christian. And I know this is a real dilemma for them in a way that it's not for those of us living in America and Australia. So I guess that's probably a very unsatisfactory answer. But I all I can say confidently is that I would avoid the two ends of the extreme, which is to make all of your politics about theology. Because quite frankly, when I read the Bible, Jesus, God didn't become a man to be a political savior. You remember that moment after he feeds the 5,000 and they try to recruit him to be a king and he retreats on his own to the mountain. And then there's the whole dialogue with Pontius Pilate, my kingdom's not of this world. You know, anyone who knows the Bible will know this kind of stuff. And so salvation is not, strictly speaking, political. This is where I differ a little bit from Metz and Maltman as well, although I'm a Protestant, so I'm conscious I have a particular position in the theological solar system. And of course, avoid that idea that Christianity should have nothing to do with politics. I find that unsatisfying and really unbiblical in its own kind of way. And we shouldn't forget that the biggest, you know, Metz and Maltman overlooked the most obvious way that the gospel did impact society. It changed the entire course of history. The entire course of history. Not many events have. In fact, I would argue that the whole Christ event was the most transformative historical event in human history. So they were living at a time that had already been completely transformed by the gospel. So it's a kind of irony to them decrying the depoliticization of Christianity in a society that had been, that was utterly the product of that man, Jesus Christ, in first century Palestine.
That's an interesting thought. And I was also thinking, as you were responding there, thinking about that Christian living in Russia right now, right? Trying to deal with some of these issues is obviously being faced with questions that you and I aren't. That being said, I've often thought you and I are somewhat disadvantaged in the cultures or the countries we live in that all of Scripture, so far as I can tell, was written by, and at least the original audience, to people who did not live in secular democratic republics, right? It was simply, you know, this whole notion of you get a voice in how the government is run was foreign to them, and possibly even unthinkable in some sense. And I think sometimes that puts, it both gives us more responsibility, but maybe less at the same time, because we're not dealing with those deeper questions. What do you do when your leaders are behaving in ways that are callous or evil? And so I'm thinking here of, you know, some of the common examples oftentimes of these arguments will boil down to things like, at least in the United States, I presume it would be the same there in Australia, access to abortion, for instance, or the legalization of abortion, LGBTQ issues, especially homosexual marriage was not as much today, but a couple of decades back was a much bigger issue here in the United States, a much more contentious debate, say. But I say you can even pull that down further to things that are even seem quaint today, such as laws against selling alcohol on a Sunday. Something like, say, abortion or homosexual relations or marriage is something that I think you could approach it from both a, say, biblical perspective, but also a secular perspective. To have a conversation with someone who does not share your moral or religious presuppositions and say, look, here is why I am against this policy or this legislation or this idea, starting with some beliefs that we both share, right? You don't have to be a Bible-believing Christian to get on board with why abortion ought not to be widely available in this particular circumstance. Not everybody accepts that. I'm just saying that there are non-theistic arguments, say, for some of these policies. But then there are things that it's difficult, like why shouldn't we sell alcohol on a Sunday? I mean, maybe one could argue historically or culturally, or maybe there were some political reasons. I think there are reasons why historically we didn't allow alcohol to be consumed or sold during election day, because they used to go get a lot of people drunk, you know, down at the local tavern and have them all go vote. I don't know how big a problem that is now, but the point being, or I guess where I'm going with this is, what is a Christian to do with that, to interact in a liberal democracy? Because it's more than just how I vote. It's also how I interact with my neighbor and how I communicate with my neighbor and the values I try to share with them. Because I'm thinking here, too, of, you know, the Apostle, if we take politics out of it completely, the Apostle Paul talks often about, or rather, when he's writing to the church, sometimes you can tell there's a difference between his admonishing of the church versus his admonishing of the world in general. And that he's not trying to hold the world to the same moral standard as the church of Christ followers because they don't adhere to that standard. Rather, he kind of shows their immorality as to how why they would need Christ. And maybe that's conflating things, but I guess where I'm going with that is, can you help me understand a little bit further as I'm interacting in my daily life and I see this is what I believe, but I believe that for a theological reason that others possibly wouldn't share. What is my duty to evangelize conservatism, say, right? Because I think sometimes that's my fear, is what I'm evangelizing is not Christianity. It's conservatism packaged in Christianity.
I think the guidance here is the notion of an apologia from the New Testament. So I think just in the same way, Christians are called to give an honest account of their faith and what they believe, I think in the political sphere, Christians should be honest about the reasons. Well, they should be honest about their positions, of course, but also honest about the theological dimension of the positions they take, whatever the issue is. I'm not sure they're called to do anything more than give an apologia, though, also taking my guidance from the New Testament. We've got to remember that the most famous or infamous teaching on politics, which is Paul in Romans 13:1, he's talking about the pagan Roman Empire, and he's teaching the Christians in Rome, at the heart of the empire, that not only do they have an obligation to submit to the authority of that pagan empire, but it has been instituted by God, which is pretty shocking. One New Testament scholar quipped, I think quite funnily but penetratingly as well, that the problem with this verse is just how clear it is, and so it just doesn't allow much room for getting out of it. And I think really what that passage is saying, and this will be the basis of my answer, is that political order and authority is legitimate in its own right, and that it's actually a good. And I think in the contemporary world, a lot of Christian conservatives don't understand that there is an extreme good in just having an ordered society. They tend to fall apart on policy questions. So, you know, you live in a generally free and prosperous and ordered society, which many humans could only dream of living in today and in the past. But you cannot be happy with that because of policy X, Y, or Z. I'm not saying those policies are unimportant and that the Christian should not be exercised by them. But I think that the real point of that I take from that teaching in Romans, which you'll also find in 1 Timothy and 1 Peter and elsewhere in the Bible, is that political order, political authority, government is actually there for the good of the human being, because the alternative is some form of anarchy, violence, rape, theft, you name it. We all know what humans are like, and we all can see even contemporary examples of where social order or political order falls apart. It really doesn't end up in a good place. Interestingly, the whole conservative tradition, albeit a bit retrospectively, is born in Burke's critical reflections of the horrors of the French Revolution. And you know, if you read Burke's reflections carefully, he concedes that some reforms were necessary. There were some problems with old Louis' regime, but tearing it all down just unleashed a whole set of human evils. And he, I think, understood an imperfect order is always going to be better than absolute freedom. And so, I mean, what am I saying in answer to your question? It's all a matter of perspective, I think, for the Christian. And so how can the conservative Christian reconcile the fact that they live in political orders, as you and I do in Australia and America, where the government passes laws, makes decisions, and pursues policies that we have really strong and unreconcilable moral disagreements with? Well, the way you do it is by recognizing that there is still a legitimacy and good that comes from having an ordered society, which in our case is freer, more law-abiding, and more prosperous than most parts of the world. That's why I say I'm not sure more than an apologia is necessary, because I think at some point, and I realize, you know, this is the point where maybe listeners, you know, take out their headphones and smash them on the ground in disgust. But I would argue as a conservative that order is always the supreme value and virtue. And so at some point, if you become too dissatisfied on discrete policy questions, you risk compromising the order. And for me, that's a cardinal sin as a conservative. And I would argue this is a Burkean idea. Look, you and I, we don't get to choose the order we're in. We don't control the culture. It is what it is. But the conservative and the Christian in particular, because I think there's some biblical teaching on this, should never lose sight of the fact that we're all called to contribute to the legitimacy of the political order in which we live, because that, if anything, is sacred. And I don't think it is. I don't really think anything in politics is sacred. But that's the key thing that affects the most people. It's not to say you can't advocate, you can't lobby, you can't campaign for particular policy positions. I think you've got to do that according to the rules of the system and recognizing the legitimacy. And part of that means, quite frankly, accepting defeat when you've been defeated. So what am I saying? I think here's a good contrast. So Trump's appointment of Supreme Justices, which led to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, I would say to a liberal, using the term in your country, is entirely legitimate, and you have to accept that and get over it. That's how everything was done according to the constitutional institutional book. It was ordered. It was a considered judgment. You can cry about it all you like, but it's absolutely legitimate. There's no grounds to attack the legitimacy of it. On the other hand, the sacking of your Capitol building, for me, was an attack on order. And even if you believe the election was stolen, there are ordered ways that recognize the legitimacy of the system to pursue that, such as through the law courts, which the Trump team did do. The problem was they got their asses whooped, as far as I can see. You know, so there are two examples of, if you like, policy questions. One, working within the system and preserving that sanctity and the premium for a conservative of order. Not everyone on the left likes order, I've got to say, too. A lot of them want to overturn order.
Especially on the far left.
Yeah, there you get the policy outcome you want whilst preserving all of those larger, somewhat intangible goods that you only notice once they disappear, how important they are. But then all those people that rioted in the Capitol building to try and overturn the election, which the conservative vice president was saying he didn't have the constitutional authority to do, kudos to Mike Pence, in my view, because he was thinking order, constitution, not the outcome I want at all costs. So that probably doesn't even come close to answering your question, because I just tended to go off on a flight of fancy.
Well, it answers maybe several others in the process. I think Mike Pence summed it up best, which when he said, look, I was disappointed with the results of the election too. my name was on the ballot after all. I thought that was an entirely fair point. And for the benefit of the listener, who presumably have a mostly American audience, since Jonathan is speaking with a foreign accent, I should probably, I don't want the slings and arrows to all head his direction. I do support that general take on January 6th. Feel free to email me, savingelephantsblog@gmail.com, if you need to vent any. Don't express your ire towards my guest. And I will say, too, it's a little bit safer being outside the United States, evoking order as that key political, you know, function or virtue. And I think we both share, we have differences, but I think we both share the same Burkean, Kirkian path to our conservative intellectualism. And yeah, I think that'd be a really fair reading of Burke and Kirk. I don't think either their critics or supporters, or they themselves, would disagree that in the question of what is the old phrase, order to liberty, if you have to take a side, they would side more with order, not that they were in any way against liberty. And that is anathema to an awful lot of people on the right who call themselves conservative in the United States. And that's totally a fair debating point. I'm by no means saying I speak for all conservatives, because I'm also an American conservative. and I know that we rally to the cause of liberty far more than conservatives the world over say. So I'm sorry, there's a lot of preamble there. I wanted to ask you, though, about conservatives. Speaking of Burke and Kirk, and I don't have anything from Burke here, but I wanted to read briefly some of these intellectual giants in the conservative movement and what they said about kind of this religious political order. Roger Scruton, the late great political philosopher Roger Scruton, talked about the Enlightenment. And he said here, and again, I'm quoting from him, "Enlightenment is a tendency that is both inherent in Western civilization and also constantly liable to be eclipsed by the human need for darkness. We are happier in Plato's cave than on the pinnacles above it. And the extreme form of enlightenment, the scientism that chases away all shadows, is also a form of light pollution, which prevents us from seeing the stars." And then here's a much shorter quote by Russell Kirk himself. "Culture arises from the cult, and that when belief in the cult has been wretchedly enfeebled, the culture will decay swiftly. The material order rests upon the spiritual order." I have a quote here from Irving Kristol, but much like Wilmore Kendall, I don't think Irving Kristol ever wrote anything short in his life. So I'm not going to read it, but the basic gist of it is that he's contending that liberal society is ill-equipped to deal with the natural disasters and chaos that is indicative of just the human race, and that the only thing that sustains liberalism or the liberal society is the religious mythos or ethos that underlies it. So these are all three coming at it from kind of a different perspective, but I think they're all kind of saying the same thing, right? Scruton's talking about how we have this need for the enchantment, basically, of Plato's cave and the light. And we can celebrate the Enlightenment and the good things modernity has brought us, but that light pollution, I like how he says that, keeps us from seeing the stars that we yearn for. Kirk talks about this whole thing's going to fall apart because the spiritual order, if it's rotten, is what the material order, we could call that politics or everything above it, rests upon. And then similar to that, Irving Kristol talking, and this is something Kristol talked about a lot, was the need for a sound spiritual order, if you will, for liberalism to work. And he talked about how the fact that liberalism has worked at all is because it is mostly running off of the gas fumes of Christendom that came before it. And who knows if that'll take place next year or 10,000 years from now, but that in theory, there's an expiration date to pure secular liberalism shorn of those religious roots. Lots of information there. I guess I'm curious, though, do you agree? Would you add color to that? Do you kind of agree with that basically? Because it sounds like all three intellectual men are kind of saying, in order to have political order, you have to have spiritual order.
Look, the truth is, I'm a little skeptical of this idea. And this is, or at least was, a central tenet of conservatism. It was really taken for granted. To go back to Burke again, there's an interesting bit early on where he basically trashes political theologians. Incidentally, he's the first person, as far as I can see, to use the term political theologian when he decries what he calls political theologians and theological politicians, and he's criticizing the dissenting preacher Farmer, I think it is, for his silly support for the French Revolution. And he basically says, you know, the pulpit has no business being in politics. This is in Reflections. And of course, for the rest of the book, he just keeps affirming why religion is central to the political.
Yeah, I know.
On the one, I think what he's really getting at is, you know, leave politics to the professionals, which I'm a little sympathetic to. There are too many ill-informed pastors, in my view, pontificating on politics without realizing it's something you actually need to study and master. It's an actual area of knowledge. It's not just something you can freelance in any more than you or I could walk in and perform brain surgery just as a hobby. But he, and ever since him, at least Christian conservatives have assumed that the bedrock of that order I was lauding moments ago has to be religious. And of course, when they use the term religion in the 18th century and 19th century, they really mean Christianity. I'm skeptical of this thesis, A, that liberalism has failed, and that the reason it has failed, you know, according to people like Yoram Hazzoni, is because of the sort of materialism of liberalism and its spiritual bankruptcy or vacuum or inability to address meaning. The reason I'm skeptical it has failed is for two reasons. One, when I read accounts of this apocalyptic world of liberal tyranny, I just don't. It's just not the empirical world I live in. I don't know what these people are talking about. Sure, there are problems. There are things that really concern me, like the assault on free speech, the whole gender fluidity issue, which I think is a sign of a society in intellectual decay that's actually abandoning Enlightenment biology, for example, and you know the mental health crisis for young people and the list goes on. And the other reason is that I'm not sure, just thinking about this honestly as a conservative, that there's anything in liberalism that promises to address the spiritual. I think liberalism is simply a mechanism for maximizing freedom, and it quite consciously leaves the citizen on their own to pursue whatever life they want. That doesn't mean that the citizen can't be spiritual. I mean, you and I are Christians living in liberal democracies, and that liberalism hasn't coerced out of us our faith. I mean, we are relatively still free to go to church and read the Bible and sing hymns. You can even proselytize. I realize around the edges that the freedoms are coming a little more constricted, and it's now more costly than it was 50 years ago, thanks to the pernicious disease of cancel culture that has come from the left. And it is a disease that infects the body politic and will destroy all of us perhaps one day. So I don't see how you could objectively and soberly say liberalism has failed. You could argue that it is failing, which is different from saying it has failed. But if you take my country, about in the last census, which was a year or two ago, and we've asked people what their religion is ever since the first census in 1901, and for much of Australian history, about 96% of people said they were Christian. Started to go into decline in the early 70s, I think it was, or late 60s, and it's now down to 44%. And we know from some reasonably reliable empirical research that about 10% of those who say they're Christians go to church. So we're looking at about 10% of 44%, just as a ballpark figure, who might be seriously committed Christians. And I have to say liberalism looks pretty strong to me. I'm not saying it's good. I just don't see a system that's about to collapse. And so that's not to say it will survive forever. I just think the pronouncements of its death just don't stack up empirically. Now, the question, so I'm skeptical of this idea that the retreat of religion, and that the retreat itself is undeniable. That's a fact. Everyone agrees on that, because the atheists revel in it, and they tell us all the time, at least in Australia. they're jubilant about the fact that those professing Christianity are now under 50% of the population. I actually don't think it has really done much, quite honestly, to the liberal order. The liberal order, at least in Australia, is exactly, it's not exactly, but it's more or less what it was in the 60s when this decline began. And so I think it has had a very negative impact, but I think conservatives are looking in the wrong place. And so what is the impact? You've got to look at the, what is difficult about this is to isolate the variable that is connected to the decline of religion, because there's been so much change. You know, is the dawn of AI got something to do with the retreat of Christianity? Well, I don't know. That's a difficult argument to make, just to throw one thing in there that is, could be the biggest change mm-hmm. in human civilization that may or may not have anything to do with the retreat of religion. Where I think it's had an impact is in mental health, actually. And here I'm going to be a bit Jordan Petersonian. This is the kind of thing he might point to. But one contender for variable that is directly a concept that directly linked to the retreat of religion is potentially the mental health crisis amongst young people, because there is some research that suggests that religion is good for your mental health, makes you happier, live longer, better health. And we have to explain this phenomenon, and none of the other accounts really are compelling to me, but there's been an explosion. There's basically an epidemic of really serious mental health issues amongst teenagers that just didn't exist when I was a teenager in the early 90s, for example. And so we have to account for this. And I think that might be one area where we really see the consequence of the retreat of religion, and that spiritual void, if you like, in the human being. And as a Christian, I think we were created in the image of God. I think we were created for a relationship with God. So I think we all have a religious impulse in us. I think we all crave the transcendent. I think we all instinctively want there to be a God. And I think it takes a lot of effort to live your life in a kind of purely materialistic zone. But the reason I pick that one, I'm not saying that's the only consequence of the loss of religion. I cite that deliberately to show why I'm skeptical about all the focus on liberalism and the liberal order, because it's not obvious to me that that's got much to do with liberalism, because I just don't think liberalism has a view on these issues. Now, you could say that liberalism without religion leads to mental health issues, potentially because religion has a function in mental health, that is promoting good mental health. But there's nothing given in the system of liberalism or the ideology of liberalism that says you cannot have religious belief. And that's why I made the point earlier that these liberal polities that conservatives are telling us have all failed still have, I mean, how many millions of evangelicals do you have in the US? It's not like when Hazzoni talks about liberalism, I mean, if there are 80 million evangelicals in your country, I'm not even talking about Catholics and non-evangelical Christians, it's not like it's a completely irreligious society. So whatever constitutes American liberalism has to include religious people, because you're just such a big part of the body politic and the culture. So I don't know if I'm making a lot of sense. I'm just trying to offer a few reasons why I'm skeptical, and I just underscore the term skeptical. I'm not saying these theses are wrong. I don't see the evidence to substantiate them. And so I'm a little reticent and cautious about embracing them. And I just wanted to raise a couple of the reasons why I'm skeptical, because to encourage people to think a bit more clearly through this.
I appreciate that. This is, and I regret that we're running low on time, because this is a whole can of worms we could get into. You are correct to critique, in my view, the failure of liberalism from some of those on the right. Patrick Deneen, of course, who wrote literally the book, Why Liberalism Failed. I think there's a lot of really interesting things in that book. I enjoyed that book. I agree with a lot of the problems he points out. I could not disagree with his solutions or lack thereof anymore. He has an almost an anti-American founding I shouldn't say almost. I think he very deliberately says, you know, the entire American experiment was almost that democracy contains within it the seeds of its own destruction. I tend to agree with that, but that's because I think as a Christian, all human enterprises contain within them the seeds of their own destruction, that there's no such thing as a system we can that we can erect that would somehow resolve or last forever or get better and better. All that being said, with the exception of Roger Scruton, who died relatively recently, the other individuals, I don't know, certainly not Russell Kirk, and I possibly fair to say not Irving Kristol. No, I feel very confident saying both of them would have strongly disagreed with the temper and the tone and the underlying thesis behind something like Dineen's Why Liberalism Failed, as far as like upsetting the entire conservative American order in order to go back to some preconceived notion of what society ought to look like. Kristol wrote the famous essay, of course, Two Cheers for Capitalism, in which he said, look, here are the good things about capitalism. A, it undeniably makes us materially prosperous in a way that humans have not found a way to obtain in the past. And B, it allows for the maximum amount of self-expression and liberty so that we're not coerced by a central authority or roving bands of, you know, bandits taking our things. But the reason it's two cheers and not three is because he says capitalism cannot create value. It cannot instill virtue. And I know that I'm using the word capitalism here, whereas earlier we're talking about liberalism, but I think we could almost interchange these two because you're right. Liberalism does not tell you how to live. It just is the mechanism whereby we have the liberty to live. And so I guess it's really interesting. Again, I regret we're almost out of time because there's a really interesting thread here I would love to pull on a bit more is that a lot of conservatives have warned as sound religion, I'll put that broadly, goes, and some others argue where there are things like Stoicism or say non-religious belief systems. Maybe to put this broadly, as individuals become themselves less likely to govern themselves, they become less governable or less likely to be self-governing. And that one of the mechanisms allows us to do that is religion. Let me be really clear here. I'm not saying you're saying this. I'm certainly not saying it. I don't mean that a person's religious is a better person than someone who is non-religious. I mean, rather, religion offers for us mechanisms whereby people can go to seek out answers for the deeper questions of life and not have to find them in a material or a political sense. And that as liberal democracies say, lose that fuel that could, in theory, over time, upset the apple cart. I'm not trying to just relitigate the whole thing, but I don't know. Any thoughts on that? Incidentally, we have about 3 minutes, so anything you want to squeeze in there?
I'll just say a couple of things quickly. One, you know, there are other impacts of the decline of religion on community, for example, because of the important role that churches used to play on charity and social services, again, because that's a role they had to play. But I think accusing liberalism of failing to meet the spiritual needs of its people or failing to sustain religion is a bit like saying the church has failed because it's not running the state effectively. Well, that's not actually its role. No one's asked it or expecting it to do that. And so I think you're demanding something from liberalism that is just not something to my knowledge, any proponent of liberalism has ever argued is the role. The whole idea is that the state is agnostic on all those substantive questions that matter and it leaves it to individuals. Now, just to qualify, I have my own criticisms of liberalism. I'm not a liberal. I'm a conservative. And one of the main reasons is liberalism, in my view, commits you to a type of moral relativism. And as a Christian, I believe there's an objective moral order and that that moral order is revealed to a large extent in the Bible. These are not views you'll find any liberal holding. In fact, they're quite anathema to a liberal. It's just that I think a liberal political order allows a conservative, or should, if it's functioning well, to be able to profess that publicly, to live it out in their life unhindered by the government, and free to try and convert people to its cause. And so there is, maybe I'll finish on this, there's a kind of paradox, isn't there, in all these conservatives who are really post-liberals, in my view, saying liberalism has failed because it hasn't produced the kind of cultural order that I like, when yet they're free to write their books and advocate for that order. And it just sounds like they're crying because they can't convince people. And they blame the system, whereas I'm not sure it's the system. I think they're just, it's a failure for whatever reason. I'm not saying it's all their fault, to actually convince their neighbors that their particular vision of how to live as human beings and in community and what kind of laws we should have are ideal.
Thanks for listening to the Saving Elephants podcast. Be sure and subscribe for future episodes. Do you have a topic or question about conservatism, millennials, the Republican Party, or anything else that you'd like us to cover in a future podcast? We would love to hear from you. Email us at savingelephantsblog@gmail.com. That is savingelephantsblog@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and catch our weekly Friday blog posts at savingelephantsblog.com. That is savingelephantsblog.com. Join us next time as we reignite conservatism for millennials.